ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
I wonder whether you still look through your old photo albums. Look, I know you're probably like me, you've got heaps of them. I still occasionally do. Some of them I haven't looked at for years. I wonder whether you still have photo albums too, for that matter. I know the trend now is to send off your digital phone pictures if you ever get round to it and get them made into a photo book, which is a kind of modern wonder in a way. But I wonder where, of all the photographs that are taken, how many end up in those? Probably not that many. There's something special about the old two-dimensional photograph, the smell, the texture of the photo album, the peeling back of the protective cover, stickiness of the pages, the fact that sometimes the photos have fallen out of position. How do you keep your old photos? And how did you take photos pre-smartphone? Maybe you had a Polaroid. Remember the Polaroids back in the 1970s? I don't know what you thought about it. I always thought a rather redundant technology in a way, apart from a gimmick. However, they've caught on again. In the mid-2000s, of course, Polaroids have come back, haven't they? What about the Kodak Instamatic? Cheap little Kodak cameras you could get for not much money. Now, not many of these photographs, though, unfortunately, because of the technology, have survived. They're almost completely faded away. Remember when you would take your film to the chemist and get it developed for $10? You'd get 24 photos back. Let's face it, only about half of them, well, less than half of them were decent, weren't they? Your Kodak memories. 1-300-800-222 is the number. The evolution of photography as a form started in Australia back in the 1850s. And tonight we're going to trace that history and look at some of the colourful characters behind the lens. Plus, what kind of story does our photographic record say about who we are? We also should get some time to talk about the glories of Kodachrome. Searching through a box of old stuff the other day, I found some Kodak slides which were taken when I was a kid. And there I am posing behind in front of Dad's car, as you often did. And what a dork I looked in my yellow Terry Towling hat. But I tell you what, the richness of the colours in that in those slides was quite something, not something you actually get today. Joining us tonight to talk about photography in all its forms from earliest times, Margot Riley is a cultural historian at the State Library of New South Wales. Margot, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, Phil.
Great to have you with us too. Also joining us, Martin Jolly, who's an artist and honorary associate professor at the Australian National University School of Art and Design. Martin, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening.
Are you both photographers? I guess you are, Martin.
Yes, I'm a photographer. I take the snaps that everybody else takes, and I also rework old archival photographs as well in my practice.
Margot, are you a photographer?
An amateur, not gifted.
Mean? You're a snapper.
I'm a snapper. I do love taking photos, yes.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I think from earliest on when I was taking photos of the kids' birthday parties, and I have a friend who's a professional photographer, he would attend the same party, taking them with... taking photographs with a camera that was no better than mine, his were much better. I realise there's something to this, isn't there?
He probably took a lot less than you took.
Come on, they were my kids. Margot, what's the earliest photograph ever taken in Australia?
In Australia, well, you were mentioning the 1850s. The process was actually discovered and patented in Paris in 1839. And it really wasn't long before that process had arrived in Australia.
This was Louis Daguerre, was it?
Yes, Louis Daguerre. And he patented the process. And then an entrepreneurial Englishman by the name of George Baron Goodman went to Paris, learned how to do the technique. He got the patent to take photographs in the colonies. and then headed off to Australia. And he really, he brought the equipment with him, the daguerreotype camera and all the polished, you had to use a copper plate. And so he brought plates.
So at this stage, you couldn't just buy a camera and take photographs. You had to get permission from Louis
You had to learn how to do it, and you had to have a patent. Yes, it was a patented process. So Goodman came to Australia. He arrived in 1842 and immediately began advertising, because these people were entrepreneurs. They were business people. And he set up his studio. It was in George Street in Sydney, the old Dimmicks building on the roof. And he built a blue glass box and immediately started, taking snaps, or not snaps, because it wasn't quick. So the idea was that you went and you made an appointment. You went and sat in the studio. It took about a minute to take a portrait, and you had to sit still. And that's why people feel that old daguerreotype portraits are very stiff. People had to be actually clamped into place, because to hold a position for a minute is really difficult, and certainly without blinking. So you had to stare into the camera.
I see. So that's why the portrait seems so stiff.
Seemed very frozen. And for a lot of people, the fact that they weren't colour, they were grey. Yes, it was a miracle to be able to have a likeness taken so quickly, but it was still expensive, and it really was only the province of the elite.
Mm. Remind us, Martin, what a daguerreotype is.
Well, it's a small plate. It's actually about the size of an iPhone, really, and it's a silver coated copper plate.
Right.
It's like looking at a mirror, and you've got to kind of hold it to the light, and when the light's coming at the right angle, this beautiful detailed image wells up from this mirrored surface, and it's kept in a case, and that case is very good for posting and for sending it to people that you love and care about, and so it's very personal, very tactile, very detailed and extremely beautiful image that you have to kind of interact
What actually is it, though? Is it like a negative? I mean, can you make more of it? It was a one-off image.
Hold it in one particular direction to the light, it does look like a negative.
Hmm.
And if you hold it in another direction and it reflects something dark, it suddenly becomes positive. It's a deposit of mercury and iodide on a polished mirror.
So once you've taken one, that's it. You can't.
Well, you could repolish the plate, and you could copy as well. So people think that daguerreotypes were quite unique, and they are in a sense, but they also were copied quite often, or were copies of other images. So they entered this big system of exchange, a global system of exchange, as well as having this beautiful tactile, iridescent quality.
Because that's the thing, Margot, isn't it, about modern photography? Of course, once you've taken a photograph, it's so transmissible everywhere that in seconds the whole world can see
it. Well, we can, send it in the flick of a switch.
But back then with a daguerreotype, once you'd taken one, well, it wasn't so transmissible at all, was it?
They passed from hand to hand. People would share them. They would show them to their loved ones and to their friends. And as Martin says, they were transportable because they were they weren't made of glass, which was the next stage in photography. So because it was on a metal plate and in that little sealed leather case, you could mail that. So that was really important for Australia, because families had been separated by emigration. The first successful the oldest surviving photograph in Australia was actually dated to about 1845, and it's a portrait by Baron Goodman of Dr. William Bland. Well, Bland was a convict. He'd been sent out to Australia for fighting in a duel, and he was a successful doctor and also a politician in Sydney. So he was a well-known personality, and that was quite the miracle of how it was identified. Because it came into the library in a pile of other photographs. We didn't know that it was there. And luckily, because he was a well-known person and we had a painted portrait with, of a very similar pose, we were able to identify it as the sitter, because that is one of the biggest issues. The identity of the sitter gets separated from the image, and that so often the biggest volume of images that survive are of unknown sitters and by unknown photographers. So this was incredibly rare, because they had also advertised, or there was an article in the newspaper saying that this photograph had been taken. So we were in one fell swoop able to identify both the sitter and the photographer.
What are some of the most precious stuff you've got there in the library?
Well, I think that would be one of the most remarkable photographs that has quite a significant value. But Goodman did also travel. Because he was entrepreneurial, as I say. So he put ads in the newspapers and he would go out to the regions. He travelled to Hobart, to Adelaide, to Melbourne. You know, he was going around trying to shoot as many people as possible, because that was his business. He was trying to make a profit out of it.
So that's right. It was mostly a male job, Martin, wasn't it? But although, tell me about Louisa Howe and her work.
Well, she's an extraordinary photographer. So she's a little bit later. She's around about 1858.
Right.
There was a kind of a bit of a men's club in Sydney at the time of amateurs and professionals working with a negative-positive process.
Mm-hmm.
But she was working with salt prints, what are called salt prints, from paper negatives, and has an extraordinary album in the National Gallery of Australia. Beautiful, sophisticated compositions of people who are visiting her home, a place called Woodlands in Kirribilli in North Sydney. And she's very aware of what the photography that's going on overseas because of all these communication networks that we've been talking about. She's obviously learning from what the blokes are doing, but she's doing something very sophisticated, setting up a little studio on her veranda, also photographing across the harbour back into Sydney Cove, where her husband worked, doing very intimate portraits of Aboriginal people who were with explorers, doing double portraits, doing picturesque views around Kirribilli. Quite an extraordinary body of work, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Tell us about another one, J.W. Newland. Tell me about his work.
Okay, well, he was sort of, Margaret's been talking about Goodman, and Goodman sold his business to his brother-in-law, Pollock, in the late 40s, and then this new person arrived on the scene, a guy called J.W. Newland,
mm-hmm.
and he had come all the way from New Orleans in America. He'd actually learnt photography in New Orleans, got the gear, all those plates that Margot was talking about, and he came right down through Central America, through South America, taking photographs all the way, across the Pacific to Tahiti, to New Zealand, and then arrived in Sydney. And he really came with new technology, better cameras, better know-how. And actually Pollock, who had taken over from Goodman, went to Auckland and kind of cooled his heels in Auckland whilst Newland was in Sydney.
Mm.
And Newland had a gallery. So he also, he took photographs, but you would go up down George Street to the corner of King Street, where he had his studio with north-facing windows to get as much light, and you'd walk up the stairs and you'd see 200 of these daguerreotypes from Texas all the way down to Sydney. So you saw this complete panorama in daguerreotype of different people from Tahiti, from South America. So it would have been quite an amazing experience to see so many photographs, so many different parts of the Southern Hemisphere.
Mm.
And then you could also get your own photograph taken for a guinea, and you could also see other Sydney.
Is that how much it cost, a guinea? That was a lot of money, wasn't it?
About a week's work for a labourer would be the value of that.
Really? Mm. Yeah.
But it's amazing, you know, how many people did. I mean, for all those reasons, family reasons.
Mm.
There's a wonderful photograph that Newland took of a guy called Edward MacDonald, who was an alderman. and he is full of life. People say that the daguerreotypes are stiff, but this guy, he's a colourful Sydney identity. He has a twinkle in his eye. He's wearing a check jacket and a striped waistcoat and a big bow tie, and he's man-spreading his knees, and he's full of this kind of Sydney, I've just, you know, got some money. He was a publican. So it was that, you know, if you were feeling flush, you'd go and get a daguerreotype taken. Mm.
Margie, you also, I mean, yes, this was, as you say, the golden era of portraiture, because that's mostly what the photographs that were taken, weren't they?
Yes, I think.
But this is because it was a commercial business, and therefore you had to sell the photograph to someone.
So. Well, that's the thing for photographers. The biggest market was portraiture, and that was the same for painters as well. They may have loved to paint landscapes, but really the money was in painting faces, even if they didn't like it. But I think we have to remember that, you know, there was high mortality at this time, and people were really aware that, you know, you wouldn't know from one season to the next whether or not a family member might not be with you any longer. So there was this incredible drive to document the faces of loved ones. I think that's really important. The other thing is that people had never had the opportunity or the capacity to really look at themselves, to see the way they appeared. And photography gave them that capacity. So it really changed the way people understood their own appearance, because otherwise they could only look in a mirror. It wasn't the same as seeing... And you couldn't study it the way you could. So if a hairstyle was unflattering, a lady would be like, oh, my gosh, I'm not going to do that again. You know, that frock didn't work, you know. So people really became aware of how they appeared to other people. And I think that was really important with something like the faces that were at Newlands Gallery, because there were celebrity photographs as well. There were well-known people from around the town, the governor. People may not have been aware of exactly how a wealthy person looked. They might not have known who they were, even though they passed them in the street. But if they went to the gallery and they could study those images, they could aspire to, you know, looking more expensive or looking more well-to-do. And I think that was a really big impetus in Australia. People always trying to make good.
Did people take photographs of their racehorses in the way they do today?
I don't think of racehorses. Certainly they took, not at that time, later, but not in when we're talking the daguerreotype and the ambrotype.
In Australia, in India, certainly racehorses were part of a daguerreotype's repertoire. And in Australia, there were portraits were certainly the dominant form, but there was also a market for street views.
Yes.
And so the new colonial buildings.
Showing success, saying how this is not a backwater. You know, we are prosperous. Look how lovely Sydney is. It's got fabulous buildings, you know, and bustling streets.
The oldest outdoor view in Australia is taken by Newland out of his window of his studio in Hobart, and that's taken down Murray Street. It's a full plate daguerreotype, so that's about the size of an iPad, and that's got all the kind of colonial accoutrements of major court buildings, hansom cabs, men in top hats, kind of conferring on the street, and then the docks in the background. So it's again, like Margaret was saying, it's another thing about colonial pride, which the photograph is able to transmit back overseas.
Mm. So when does landscape photography become a thing? Margot?
Well, it happens when we get to the next stage of photography, and we get the development of the wet collodion negative.
This is the next piece of technology, important piece of technology after daguerreotypes.
Yes, so we start to have photograph negatives made on glass, and you could either turn that negative into a positive for portraiture, and that was known as an ambrotype. Mm-hmm. So we're talking, you know, 1850s, mid-1850s, and then towards and that's when you really start to see people taking view pictures. Mm-hmm. But the issue with wet collodion photography is that you have to prepare the plate, activate it within 20 minutes. So you have to be, if you're going out, you have to take with you a dark room. So you have to take your, you know, a portable dark room with you, plus all the glass plates, plus all the chemicals to actually activate the plate, expose it, and then develop it all in this one process.
Mm. See, I was thinking before the program began, I wonder why there aren't more photographs. I mean, I know there are some, but why there aren't more photographs of famous moments in 19th century history. Well, you know, why there aren't more photographs of Ned Kelly, for example. There are some, aren't there?
But, there's an amazing photograph taken by J.W. Lent, which is of the body of Joe Byrne, who is a member of the Kelly gang, which has been strung up on a door in order to be photographed by the Bulletin photographer. So that moment in the 1880 is a moment where one mode of journalism, if you like, which is a wood engraving and the drawer, is kind of intersecting with a new emerging mode, which is the photographer. And that's a moment where the wet plate that Margot's been talking about begins to transition to the dry plate. So you have that slightly more mobility. And so Kelly was a photographed figure.
Yeah.
There were carte visites of him, and so he's really the kind of beginning of that news photography.
Yeah. We're talking about the history of Australian photography. Babette in Wollongong says, Phil, your guests probably know, but one of the first photographs ever taken in France was of Chopin. He was very ill at the time with tuberculosis. There you go. Yeah.
Celebrity portraiture, very early.
All right. Let's move. There is so much to talk about, and there's a lot to cover here. By the turn of the century, we start to get, don't we, standalone rolls of film.
Well, yeah. Kodak invent the box brownie, the sort of point and shoot, the beginning of that type of technology. And within that camera, first it starts with sheet film camera, but eventually they develop the roll. In first instance, this is about 1889, you would buy the film in the camera, you would take your photographs, and it could be up to 100 shots, pretty good value.
Yeah.
But then you had to actually send the camera back for them to develop, take the film out and develop it. And then they would send it back to you with a new roll of film in. And of course, the next development was that the film could go into a little canister and you would be able to extract that, and then you could take it to be developed yourself. You didn't have to send the whole camera back.
A piece of technology essentially which stayed the same until the invention of digital photography,
yes,
really, didn't it?
Yes.
This democratised things hugely, though, Margaret.
Yes, it did. And I think it became popular again because, Martin's already mentioned someone like Louisa Howe, but she was very much a lady photographer. It was a very educated and very skilled type of photography that she did. But it really pushed up women participating in photography, the box brownie, and having access to a type of photography that didn't really require too much knowledge of chemistry or anything like that. It was much simpler.
Sue from Pakenham's with us. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Now, I have a photograph of my grandmother in 1890. She was about 20 years of age at the time, and she's dressed in academic gown. I'm aware that when people went in for photographs, they would dress up. You know, in they'd have options of things to put on for their photographs. My question is, well, to the Melbourne listeners, I guess, was this a common dress that women could choose to have their photograph taken? Or, what I'd rather think, is she one of the first graduates of the University of Melbourne? In which case, I probably should find out, shouldn't I? Yeah.
Well, I think the main thing about photography is that it documents rites of passage.
Yeah.
So weddings, graduations, you know, all of those moments in life, were the occasions that you went to a studio, because in those days you really did have to go to a studio to have a formal portrait taken. But women were attending, starting to have further education. She may have been at a ladies' academy. She may not have actually gone to university. And, you know, having an academic robe was something that was worn in ladies' academies as well as at universities. So I do think there's potential that she had graduated. She might have graduated from high school. How old did you say she was?
She was 20 when this photograph was taken.
Yeah, so it's possible. It's probably not a high school, though. So then it's probably likely to be a ladies' academy, something, an extra level of education that she may have had access to.
Mm. Martin, when does colour photography arrive?
Well, colour photography depends where you define colour photography. A lot of photographs were hand coloured. In fact, even daguerreotypes were hand coloured.
Right,
beautiful.
A lot of daguerreotypes have little touches of gold paint on.
You mean an artist would actually paint the photo?
Very skillfully. Right. With very skilled work.
And often we suspect women's labour as well. And a little bit of touch of blush to the cheeks sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes colouring to the clothes too. So, but in terms of actual what you could be called natural colour, towards the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, there's various experimentations with different colour processes. One in Australia that's quite popular is called the Paget plate, which was used fairly extensively by various people, which is like a kind of matrix of different colours, a little bit like a kind of TV screen. And that develops into different processes through the 20th century.
Mm. And we actually had the French developed the autochrome, and that was made available on the market. It was developed by the Lumiere brothers, who had invented the cinematograph.
Mm-hmm. And
So they were available. You could buy them, and there was actually a practitioner in Sydney, a man by the name of William Gullick, who was the government printer. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of early adoption of new techniques in Australia, and Gullick was an absolute pioneer of the use of the autochrome, and he took stunning photographs. The thing with it, again, it was really good for portraiture because you got beautiful skin tones. It was wonderful for taking photographs in the garden, but the trouble with it was it was a glass plate, and yes, it had these colour patches. It was actually potato starch grains that were flattened, and they were dyed different colours. So there was blue, red and green, and you had to put but the beauty of the autochrome was that you could just put it into your standard camera. You didn't need special equipment, and so it was relatively easy to use, but it was expensive. It was much more expensive than a standard black and white glass negative. And the trouble with it was that it was a transparency. It was a glass transparency. So you actually had to display it on a special little stand. So it was limited. It was expensive, and it really had limited possibilities for use. But we certainly had early practitioners here. And we have some wonderful examples of Gullick's autochromes at the library in our collection, as well as Paget plates that were shot by Frank Hurley. So Frank Hurley took Paget plates with him when he went to Antarctica. Yes, both of the 1911 and the 1914 expeditions. And also when he was a war photographer and he went to Egypt and to France, he took Paget plates in 1917 and 18. Really extraordinary.
Mm. There was a whole period. I remember seeing an exhibition in Canada once of that huge format landscape photography too, which was taken. And I'm trying to think of the photographer now. Martin, help me here, but
in Western America,
yes.
Yosemite National Park. Yeah, it could have been Jackson or O'Sullivan or.
Yeah. Anyway, but the photograph, but the equipment was huge. The cameras were the size of refrigerators. And,
well, that was the thing. In those days, they didn't have enlargement. Mm. So if you wanted a big picture, you had to actually take a big photograph. And really the best example of that is, and we have this, we have the world's biggest glass plate negatives at the State Library,
right.
which were shot by Charles Bayliss, who was working for, again, another entrepreneur, another immigrant, who was very proud of his success in Australia, and he wanted to take this travelling show around the world and promote Australia to the world. So photography's always been this amazing photograph, a promotional tool. So Holtman had a property house in North Sydney. He built a special tower, and he actually constructed a room on the top of the tower which acted as the aperture of the camera. So these massive sheets of shop window glass, they were a metre by a metre and a half, were coated with the collodion and then activated and put up against the windows, exposed on three sides to create this massive panorama of Sydney Harbour. Mm. And that was in 1877.
Mm. We're talking about Australian photography. Margot Riley, who you just heard speaking, is a cultural historian at the State Library of New South Wales, which has got tremendous repositories of Australian photographs. And Martin Jolly's with the Australian National University School of Art and Design. He's an artist and a writer. You've written about photographic exhibitions, about 10 of them, Martin, which you say really shaped Australia's identity. Tell me about two of those.
Oh, okay. Well, me and my colleague, we tried to take another look at photography through its impact on society through the way it's actually shown. So we sort of retell that familiar story through shows. So one of the most important shows we think is that show I just talked about, the Newlands exhibition of 200 daguerreotypes. Mm-hmm. But if you fast forward to, say, 1986, for instance, you've got one of the first exhibitions of Indigenous photographers that's at a very small gallery in Sydney, the Aboriginal Artist Gallery run by Ace Burke. And it's introducing a whole generation of what were to become really important Indigenous photographers, Tracy Moffat, Michael Riley, Brenda Croft, Mervyn Bishop. And this show was quite small in a small gallery small prints hung on a brick wall. But if you look at the subsequent history of the way that these photographers really reshaped the visual grammar that we use to talk about Indigenous issues, it was an incredibly important show. I think that's one of the aspects of photography, that it you can do quite modest things, but you can have quite a large impact. So that was one of the shows that we think was a really significant turning point. And there's other shows. For instance, there was an institution called the Australian Centre for Photography that began in 1974. And there was a show there about a couple of years after it opened by William Yang called Sydney Files, which I think has been reprised at the State Library.
Yes,
That really introduced that whole flowering of gay and lesbian culture in Sydney was really kind of opened up by William Yang's work.
And I've been working with William for the last 2 years to recreate the Sydney Files exhibition, which is currently on at the State Library of New South Wales. And we've been able to acquire William's entire 1970s archive of over 22,000 negatives, which are just an extraordinary whole of life cache of his interaction with all sorts of people in Sydney. He was a young Asian Australian photographer, grew up in Brisbane, came to Sydney, and it was really at the time he came in late 60s, moving into the early 70s, that flowering of the LGBTQI scene in Sydney. And William was absolutely part of that, and he had entree into the social world of both celebrities, actors, and real social life. He was in the ferment of it. And his exhibition was unusual for many things, but one reason was colour. There was a lot of colour, and the ACP had traditionally focused on black and white photography. And the way he put it together, the standard way was, you know, metal frames and a nice long line. Well, William came in and he jammed all of the photographs up tight against the wall, just like you were in a party. And they're all jostling for position and jostling for attention. And as they said, in the press releases afterwards, there were just as much action on opening night with all those faces who were on the walls, also in the room and trying to, because it was a bit of a thing about, you know, am I there? You know, William often says, you know, people ask him, you know, why did people let you photograph them like in those situations, different party situations? And William says, because half the time they were terrified they'd be left out. So they were very keen for him.
When do we start thinking about photography as an art form? I mean, photographers like Max Dupain's famous photograph, what's it called? The Bathers, I think.
Sunbaker.
When do we start thinking, gee, you know what, photography is not just a record of what's there, it's also, it helps us to change our perspective our view of the world.
Yeah, it's been a perpetual desire from photographers right from the beginning to be seen as artists, and I think it really takes shape as a movement with the introduction of small hand cameras we discussed earlier in the 1890s. And so you do have the amateur photographers. Then you have a group called the pictorialists, and they are using hand cameras, but they are seeing themselves as being self-consciously artistic. They're forming clubs, they're forming societies like the Sydney Camera Circle. They're making what are called pictorialist prints, which have a kind of reference to printmaking or to drawing or to painting in the way that the surface of the print is handled. And they're forming networks. We've been talking about networks. So they're sending prints back to London. They're having salons, having exhibitions. And they're actually beginning to ask art galleries, like the Art Gallery of New South Wales, whether they can start collecting photographs in the 1940s. Of course, the Art Gallery of New South Wales says no way. And it's not really until the 1970s that the major galleries begin to collect photography as a, as an art form. Mm. And that's at the end of the 1960s and the 1970s, and movements overseas around 35mm photography. And then that really has become now the very much the, you know, intrinsic DNA of contemporary art. We see
you might think it's at the absolute center of contemporary art. You'd think photography and photographic technique, isn't it?
Well, it's the basis of so much painting. It's the basis of so many of the projections that we see, you know, major shows like Vivid Sydney and so forth. It's not so much now a distinct art form the way that it might have been with the Australian Center for Photography, but it's really become such a driver. Because it's a driver of media, it's become the driver of contemporary art as well. So it's, you know, it's conventional to say, oh, the 1970s, but in fact, there was a lots of you know, photographers who wanted to see themselves to be seen as artists, even in the late 19th century.
You wonder, Margot, what photography has done to us as a community, in the sense that given that we've got these photographs of people that have come before us, the people in the 19th century didn't have that. They just had oral histories of people. We've got photographic histories of people, whether or not this has changed our perspective of who we are and what our place in the world is.
Well, I think that's one of the major difference between, say, a library collection and an art gallery is that libraries, of course, collect for information. And so there has been a much stronger drive within library collections to actually acquire photography. We've had, you know, photographic acquisitions going from, you know, quite early in the 20th century. And I think it is that thing of wanting to know how people looked in the past, what the world looked like in the past.
How did we live? Yeah.
And, you know, we have extraordinary survivals. One is it's a beautiful ambrotype. It's a large format ambrotype from 1856, and it's the sole surviving sailor of the wreck of the Dunbar. And he was just an able seaman. He would never have had his photograph taken on this scale because it would have been a very expensive photograph to have had. And again, that's an example of local celebrity. So the photographer on spec has taken this photograph so that he can hang the photograph in, you know, the sort of foyer of his studio and encourage people, because people were so wanted to have know about the Dunbar, to the point, though, that the poor gentleman then became recognised in the streets and small children were sort of running after him.
Wow, and the beginning of celebrities.
Yeah, so but he was somebody who wasn't courting celebrity. And so he eventually had to shave off his beard so that the children wouldn't recognise him. So, you know, I think that's that real human side of photography and how important a photographic image is, you know, to be able to have the face of this weathered, you know, sole survivor of an epic event like that. Yeah. You know, really nothing would compare to seeing this stunning colour image because it is a beautiful colour amber type. That is just extraordinary.
George from South Australia has texted in saying Kodachrome colour slides apparently have an archival life of up to 200 years.
We collect them. We love them.
A digitally cleaned up scan of an old Kodachrome transparency can produce a print that looks as though the image was captured yesterday. Well, I know from my own Kodachrome slides, you would attest to that, this rich saturated colour, which is quite extraordinary. When does it arrive, Kodachrome, Margot?
It's really a product of, you know, it's invented in the sort of, I think it's in the 40s, but it's expensive. But I think people definitely have it and have access to it in the 60s. There's so many sets of family holiday snaps and, you know, they do come into our collections. And professional photographers are using them. We have a wonderful slide collection from David Moore. So we see some of David's colour work, which we're not so familiar with. Most people are more familiar with his black and white prints. Yeah. But the colour work is also extraordinary.
Kodachrome is a developing process, is it?
No, it's a colour positive film.
It's a slightly different process to, say, ectochrome.
Yes, ectochrome is the print.
Ectochrome, you bleach the dye out, whereas with Kodachrome, you build the dye up.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why it's so stable. It has such beautiful colour. Reds particularly. The reds survive so well and they look so gorgeous. And don't forget, Kodachrome is also used for Super 8. So a lot of the Super 8s that people shot in the 60s still have that beautiful characteristic Kodachrome red. Because you could choose Kodachrome as your shooting stock.
Well,
yeah. So, but it is that the kind of apogee of that chemical industrial process that just hit that sweet spot of conservation and those beautiful reds.
I wonder what the oldest photo you have. 1-300-800-222. What's the oldest photo you have, or one that you treasure the most? You might like to share it with us. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Wendy says, "Evening, Phil. I've got a large famed photogravure of the lawn at Flemington on Melbourne Cup Day by Carl Cooler."
That's right. Yes, we have them at the library. They're stunning. They're the most wonderful document because they have so many people in them. And you really get to see an array of what people might have been wearing and doing and being at the races. They're wonderful.
Wyle says, "I've got a photo of my grandfather in full military dress uniform receiving his military medal in 1919.
Fabulous.
Yep.
Can we jump to the digital revolution? We lose something here, don't you? I mean, this completely democratizes photography, doesn't it? Because anyone can take a photograph anywhere, anytime, for any purpose whatsoever, and they're not valuable anymore. Once upon a time, you used to think, do I really want to take this shot? Because I've only got 12 photos left in my camera, and I don't know whether I want to waste one on this. Now, this disappears with digital photography, doesn't it? What do we lose, Margaret?
I think it does, but my partner is, you know, an old-school photographer, used to having the SLR. So, you know, when he's got his phone camera, he takes ages and he takes 3 shots and he misses the moment because that's, I think, the beauty of a digital camera. It's instantaneous. You can check it. You can self-edit. You can correct it through editing software. You know, it really allows us to be very present in a moment with our families and with events that are happening. And we look at that with news coverage around the world. The first thing that comes out, even if there's a disaster or, you know, a momentous, you know, event, people are on the street and they're able to capture it, which is, you wouldn't have been able to do before. A, you wouldn't have known whether you got the shot, and you had to wait till it was developed. And, news photographers had to, you know, rip the film out and then either, you know, mail it or, you know, courier it to have it developed or send it down to the news desk. So there was that lag and you really didn't know whether you had the shot or not.
What do you think we gained, Martin?
Well, no, I think with mobile phones, I think that there is a discrimination. Certainly there's, you know, that scattergun approach, but there's a decision that we make about what image to put on our home screen, for instance. And that's a very personal decision, intimate decision. So whether we have our pet cat or whether we have our children. So I think that desire to have and to hold and to keep things precious, I think that still exists in the...
What's on yours, Martin? What's on your home screen, Martin?
Well, my partner has our cat and I have our two daughters. So I don't know what that says.
I've got my two daughters.
Exactly.
Margo,
exactly.
What have you got?
A step-grandson.
And that's my point. So So
yeah, nothing's really changed.
No, and I think what's different too is, you know, there's so many pictures. We have every step of their lives, which didn't happen in the past. You know, many people have maybe one or two or half a dozen images of either themselves or their parents at different times. And that's something that has changed. You know, I have an elderly mum, and it's just so wonderful to be able to, you know, in this, you know, these last years, make sure I've got a really lovely record of her and with our family. So you don't have to worry about film or processing or any other thing. You know, you've got the snap.
Margot, though, as an archivist and as an historian, though, do you worry about what we're going to lose here because with this? I mean, I think about my own photographs ever since. I've still got my Nikon SLR camera, although I haven't put a roll of film in it for years. But I'm going to after tonight's. You've inspired me, again. But all the photographs that I have are, you know, in a computer. And when
And that is
they can be lost like that.
Well, because they're not identified. And, you know, once they're out of your memory or out of your, you know, you can't even recognise the people sometimes, you know, because time goes by and you forget. Yeah. So that's the biggest issue. And look, that's not a new problem. As I say, we've got endless numbers of unidentified photographs from the past. Mm. But I do think, if anything, you know, that is something that people should be doing. I think there was a lot of it done during the pandemic. People were going through their photographs and sort of cataloguing them a little bit and, you know, maybe printing them out or having, you know, just thinking it through a little. But I do think that is probably the biggest challenge going forward.
Mm. Betty, your mother was a photographer, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yes, back in just after the or before during the First World War.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where did she shoot? Where what was she taking photographs of, Betty?
Oh, mostly her family, and I've got photos. Oh God, I've got numerous negatives and that I've brought to the right one. And she worked for a place down in Campbell Street, down near the railway station, and her father was the picture framer, and she used to take the photos, and then if they were black and white, she'd colour them herself, and they're beautiful.
these were photos on paper, were they?
They're proper film. Yes, I've got the negatives and everything, and she used to mostly take them in Centennial Park in the Rose Garden.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd colour them all up and everything. And oh, yes, she was a little devil. And she'd take photos of her sister-in-laws in their swimming costumes and all that sort of thing, yeah, back in the 1918s. And she really enjoyed that, yes. And so I've got numerous photos of her. But I do have a photo of my great-grandmother. It must have been taken in the late 1800s, from what I can gather. And she was a bride. And, it's beautiful too, yeah. I've got many photos.
Good on you, Betty. And nice memories too. Just talking about technology, Martin and Margot. I mean, I know there's a panic every time there's new technology, but an AI photo did win the Sony World Photo Competition recently. I mean, at least the creator of the photo refused to accept the award, saying, "I just did it to see what would happen." But given that AI can create a photograph of anything, pretty much, is photography finished?
No. Of course it's not, because people still want images of their relatives that we've been talking about. They still want to see the events of the world that they've been talking about.
Mm.
And there's still protocols. I mean, we shouldn't fall into the trap of just thinking that technology determines everything. Technology is about how we use it, how we adopt it, how we incorporate it into our desires and wants and our behaviors. So there's always going to be a demand for that connection, and that's always going to mean that photography, whether it be analog or digital or even AI generated, is going to connect us to other people and connect us to the world that we live in. So I don't think that AI will just become another one of those tools that we've always had to embellish, to manipulate, to change.
Mm.
And we've always had those tools.
Mm.
And I think it's interesting too, because, you know, in the past, the craft of photography wasn't necessarily just about taking the photograph. It was making the photograph. And really the AI is just giving that creator the opportunity and the tools to make an image, because he's crafted that. It's not, he didn't take it, he made it. He actually constructed it. And I think that's
a really nice continuity.
We
can never trust one again, could we?
Well,
maybe you can't trust photographs anyway.
People were saying that when digital photography came in. They were saying it was the apocalypse. This is in the early 1990s, almost 30 years ago now. And, you know, we'd never be able to trust a photograph again because it wasn't an actual photon of light hitting into a chemical emulsion. But of course we do trust photographs because they are social. They're not just technological, they're also social and are human.
And there's information too. There's information in a photograph that can often determine, you know, whether how it was made. And I think that's the point with the Sony photographer as well. You know, he said it didn't stand up to scrutiny. You could see that it was crafted. It wasn't from life. And that was why he made it. It was a beautiful image, but he was never intending to fool anybody.
TJ and Tassie says, Phil, the art of winding on the 35mm film onto the old analog Mamiya to enable getting an extra 3 frames out of the rated 24 has been lost forever. I don't think so, has it, Martin? Because, I mean, you can still buy 35mm film. In fact, maybe you'll be able to buy it forever. Maybe it's the art of
compressing your JPEG down so you can squeeze a few more onto your thumb drive.
But people are still taking photographs on film, though, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yeah. And they're still making ambrotype. They're still making daguerreotype. It is this fascination with the process and with the finished product, the look and feel of it. You know, a black and white print taken on film is very different to one that's taken, you know, we talked about it earlier about the wet collodion process. You know, that is there's no grain. So you can actually, those early black and glass plates, when we digitise a glass plate, that you can blow, even though they didn't have enlargement technique at the time, we can now look right into the every detail in a 19th century glass plate photo because of that.
Richard's text is saying, I work at a school in Geelong. We've got 100 year 10 students doing black and white film photography and they are loving it. It's been a rapid ride through Australian photography, but fascinating as well. I do thank both of you. Margot Riley's a cultural historian at the State Library of New South Wales. Thanks, Margot.
Thanks.
And Martin Jolly's at the ANU, the School of Art and Design. Thanks, Martin.
Thank you.
Thanks to both of you. And thanks for the texts and memories too.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.